Thank you, Tim, for leading us in those songs. Very spirited singing. Appreciate that. And appreciate all that have sung out in worship and glory to our Father. Well, you've heard me past few weeks mentioning looking forward to getting back to a series on David. Not there yet. I got a few more weeks, I think, a few more topics that I feel will be helpful and needed to the congregation. But I thought I'd just, again, remind folks, because I know there's some that may be new here and have not been part of that series on David. Go online, Franklin, 31W, Franklin, 31WChurchOfChrist.com. That's the website. And if you haven't heard any of them, I think there's 54 of them you'd have to catch up on. There's a lot of David lessons. But I needed to take a break for a little while and preach on some other things. This is a lesson, might say a loosely connected series on leadership. As I've mentioned from time to time, I want to speak on this subject, hoping to instill in our men many of the attributes to be the leaders God has called all men to be. Yes, elders are needed, but they are not the only leaders, right? There are song leaders, class leaders, or teachers. There's those that need to be active, involved in having home Bible studies, those that take the lead in that. Even women are to seek to be wise leaders of their children. But in a church, those that God has selected to be leaders are the elders. And a church should not be forced into rushing in and choosing men. In fact, that may push men away. We would rather it happen as a growth process, organically and naturally. So occasionally we've been doing lessons on leadership, as those skills must be cultivated in men first before everyone looks at if one qualifies. So we have been occasionally looking at biblical leaders and what we can learn from them, haven't we? We've learned from Peter, the great leader. That was one lesson. And another lesson was lessons on leadership from Paul leading a ship. And if you want to, you can go online and listen to those. Today we'll be learning from Nehemiah, a wise master builder. We have some kids that really like Legos. You know, the best brick builders are called master builders. I like to call Cody that, because he loves Legos most of all the kids. He's always been good at puzzles and Legos. One time I told him, I said, "Did you know that the term master builder is in the Bible?" And he said, "Yes, I knew that." And I was surprised. I said, "Well, how?" He said, "Well, I heard you read it from the Bible one time." Well, kids do listen, don't they? They certainly do. And that phrase was something that meant something to him. Well, one thing we learn about Legos and master builders and some of the shows that you see about that is that those people that are on those episodes are not picking up a Lego for the very first time in their life. In fact, often it shows their life story, and it shows pictures of them as children playing and building with Legos. They've been building all their lives, and that's how they came to that particular point where they are now referred to as master builders. In like manner, the same is true with leadership. One does not born that. One does not all of a sudden one day, like a light switch, become that. They rather grow into that by diligent effort and practice, like Lego master builders. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, there verse 9 and 10, Paul says, "For we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building." He's speaking about the church of Christ, as a building, an edifice. Well, a building has to be built. And he says there in verse 10, according to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. One has to be cautious and careful as to how they build up the house of God, which is the church of the living God. For it is the pillar and ground of the truth. God's church is God's building. And people are either being built up or torn down. Paul said he wisely considered his place in the kingdom and sought to be a wise master builder. And so too should we. Leaders must take care as to how they build. It must be wisely. Well, Nehemiah likewise was a wise master builder. While Paul worked on the spiritual kingdom, Nehemiah worked on the physical one. And there are great lessons we can learn in leadership from him as to how he accomplished his task. Let's begin in Nehemiah chapter 1. Let's turn there together. Nehemiah chapter 1. And let's begin reading there in verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaleth. It came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. So it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night. So Nehemiah hears the words of news in Jerusalem and he laments the fact that the walls are broken down. And he instantly goes to God in prayer. One thing we learn here at the beginning of Nehemiah, a wise master builder, is that he identified the problem and he prayed about it. And he did this before he did anything else. See, good leaders will keep their ears to the ground. They don't look to create problems, but rather to solve problems. But in order to solve something, you must first understand it. So leaders don't bury their heads into the sand or turn a blind eye to a problem. Others might, but leaders don't. There's a whole lot of other Jews around, right? But Nehemiah was a Jew that took the lead. And we notice that his first action is not a reaction, but rather a reflection, isn't it? He prays to God. And in his prayer, he reflects about what has taken place in the past and what God has promised also in the past. In verse 7, he says, we have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out to the farthest parts of heaven, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Now these are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant. and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man." Nehemiah looks into the past. He knows it is the sins of Israel that has led them to this. The captivity was their fault. But he also knows that God keeps his promises. And God promises to preserve a remnant. And this is it. "So I know by the help of God," he says, "we can do this." In essence, we were born to do this. This is our lot in life. This is our place in time. So Nehemiah demonstrates great leadership, not by instantly acting, but by instantly praying. Look, if we wish to be wise master builders, then we need to go to the greatest builder of all time first. And that is God. And we need to ask Him. Nehemiah is coming and casting his cares on Him, praying for courage, praying for wisdom. The book of James, in James chapter 1, James 1 and verse 5, it says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God." If you lack the wisdom, ask of God. You want to be a wise master builder, ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. God says, ask for wisdom. No doubt Nehemiah was doing that. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 7. 1 Peter chapter 5, there in verse 7. What does it say there? It says, "Casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you." How much care should you reserve for yourself? He says, none. You cast it all on Him because He cares for you. And isn't it interesting that these words are said after verses 1 through 4, which talks about elders, right? Chief shepherd. We follow chief shepherd. Elders to be leaders, not lords over the flock. Then later on he says, casting all care upon Him, for He cares for you. We've got to be doing that. Leaders spend much time on their knees and don't do anything without having done that first. So he identified the problem and then he prayed about it. But next, Nehemiah, he came up with a solution. Back there in Nehemiah chapter 1, you notice there in verse 11, where at the end of verse 11, he says, "I pray and grant him mercy in the sight of this man." In the sight of this man. This man was King Artaxerxes. He knew he would need to talk to the king about it. This was a scary risk, but he put his own life on the line because he knew how important this was. He says, "For I was the king's cupbearer. Give me mercy in the sight of this man, the king." So in chapter 2, verse 1, "And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. Therefore the king said to me, 'Why is your face sad, since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart.' So I became dreadfully afraid and said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the palace, the place of my father's tombs lies waste and its gates are burned with fire?' Well, the king said to me, 'What do you request?' So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it.' Then the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him, 'How long will your journey be? And when will you return?' So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. The king hears Nehemiah's worries and his anxieties, what was bringing him down, what was depressing him. And he was sympathetic. And he only asked, how long will your journey be and when will you return? And chapter 2, verse 6 says, so I set him a time. How did Nehemiah do that? How did he set him a time? Well, he did that because he came up with a solution. See, he had a plan. He wasn't just moping. He was prepared with a plan. He knew exactly about how long this was going to take. Furthermore, Nehemiah had specific requests. Again, how, unless he had thought it through? Notice verse 7. Furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy. And the king granted them to me, according to the good hand of my God upon me. I'm impressed. Nehemiah ran the numbers. He had done the calculations. He knew how much lumber would be needed. He anticipated the problems with other nations that might come up about this. And he calculated a time for all of this to take place. He had a strategy in place. And what makes this remarkable is that Nehemiah is no mason or building contractor. He was a cupbearer to the king. That really emphasizes that he had to hit the books. He had to ask around. He had to get the facts and figures because it wouldn't be inherent in his mind. So he knew how to identify a problem and research how to solve the problem. He wasn't winging it. He wasn't making things up on the fly as he went along. He had carefully counted the cost and had a well-formulated plan to present to the king. And all of this flowed from the willingness to take initiative as a leader. See, there must be a go-getter attitude, but that must be followed up by careful planning. Don't wing it. I remember years ago watching a movie called Apollo 13. I think it was Apollo 13. Maybe some of you have seen it. Of course, it was based on the actual events that took place in history with the Apollo 13 going around the moon. And the great problems it started to have on its return to Earth. And they lost basically all power to make it back to Earth, but they recognized that whatever remaining power they might have had left in the battery cells, if it was not calculated wisely as to how it was going to be spent, they're going to miss the Earth, and they're not going to make it back home. And so they had all these, quote, wise master builders running the numbers, crunching the figures, running the test, seeing how much amperage certain things would put on the, what they were on, the spaceship, whatever it was called, excuse my lack of memory, and how to be able to get it back safely. And if you didn't turn things on in the correct sequence and order, they were going to run out of juice and wouldn't be able to fire the thrusters. Ultimately, they figure out the plan. There's just one attempt at it, one shot. And it was just enough juice to fire on those thrusters. Even the navigational system would not work. It had to be navigated by eye, based upon the angle of the Earth within the window. They made it happen. Nothing was done by the seat of their pants. Careful calculations. When it comes to the church, we have to think about that. Men especially. In a group, made up of many different people, of different ages, different stages, male and female, children and elderly. We have to always make sure that we think things through. Sometimes individuals don't, and they pay the price for that. It can cause people to discount your leadership or blow you off the next time. Be a wise master builder. Let us remember, it's easy to throw ideas out there, but harder to think them through to the end. Nehemiah had done so. And this becomes more clear in chapter 3. In chapter 3, as there's a chronicle of names of those that worked on the wall, and his skill as an organizer shines through that chapter as he has a plan of who can work where as he divides the wall into small, manageable portions. Look there in chapter 3. Chapter 3 there, verse 1. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, the priest, and built the sheep gate. And they consecrated and hung its doors, and they built as far as the Tower of the Hundred and consecrated it, then as far as the Tower of Hanel. Next to Eliashib, the men of Jericho built. And next to them, Zerker, the son of Imri, built. And on one might be able to go to see how different people were selected for different parts. This is effective leadership. It's wise team building. And this wise leader, what does he do? Well, we see there in chapter 3, next, he gets others involved, doesn't he? He delegates responsibility. He couldn't and he didn't build the whole wall himself. That would be impossible. So he delegated responsibility. He appointed trustworthy men to oversee the actions of the laborers. Notice in chapter 3, verse 17, after him, the Levites under Rehum, the son of Bani, made repairs. Next to him, Hashabiah, leader of half the district of Keilah, made repairs for his district. So he had the combined effort of multiple teams going on and team leaders. This would help him get the work done and get the work done fast. And he wisely assigned people to work close to their homes. I think this is very wise. Notice in chapter 3, verse 10. 3:10, next to him, Jedidiah, the son of Harmuth, made repairs in front of his house. And next to him, Hattush, the son of Hashabniah, made repairs. Notice in verse 23, and after him Benjamin and Hashabah made repairs opposite their house. After them Azariah, the son of Messiah, the son of Ananiah, made repairs by his house. Look at verse 28, drop down to verse 28. Beyond the horse gate, the priests made repairs, each in front of his own house. After them, Zadok, the son of Immer, made repairs in front of his own house. After him, Shemaiah, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the east gate, made repairs. And after him, Hananiah, the son of Shelemiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zalphath, repaired another section. After him, Meshulam, the son of Berechiah, made repairs in front of his dwelling. This gave people quick access to their work site. I mean, it's literally out the front door, as opposed to them going to the other side of the city. But it was also an extra incentive to the people. Why is that? Well, no one would want the part of the wall next to his own house to be weak or sloppy or crooked, right? That was wise. Others might not care as much if it was elsewhere, right? If they don't have to look out their front window and see it every day. But if it was in front of theirs, there might be a little extra attention to detail. I mean, you and I know it. Do you know how hard and how rare it is to find a craftsman who would work on your home as if it was his own? that takes that kind of pride in his work? See, Nehemiah knew how to get the most out of each man's labor. And his plan guaranteed that they would take pride in their work and assured that he'd finish their task. Because no one wants a hole in the wall in front of their house. Not too long ago, Thomas was showing me some of the areas of the contractor that had come and done their driveway, hadn't paid attention to some of the details. Do you think if it was their house, might they have done that? You know, for sure they would have paid more attention, right? Nehemiah wisely knew it too. He knew. Now listen, if Nehemiah just built it himself, if he had that energy, that it would be perfect, right? If he'd do it, he'd do it perfectly. But he also knew he could not build it all. So he had to delegate the responsibility in order to do this. And he did so wisely. Now let me say, delegating responsibility, it's a lot easier to say than do. I mean, especially if something's important to us, you say, let me do it right. I mean, why is that more women don't include their daughters in baking and cooking? Right. You know the answer to that. Or get their kids more involved in dusting and cleaning. Because if I do it, it's going to get done right, right? You see? So it's very, very hard to delegate responsibility. Same when it comes to the church as well. But listen, leaders that don't do that, they're going to be cranky. They're going to be frustrated. They're going to feel burned out. And moms too, by the way. Right? If you don't delegate. Burnout is real. You remember Elijah? He got burned out. And God said, here's Elisha. You need to delegate some of that responsibility. You remember Moses? He was trying to judge all the people. He was hearing cases all day, every day, 24/7. And Jethro came and told him, what you're doing is not good. So he appointed leaders among the people that they might act as a first line of defense. He's delegating responsibility. Remember Jesus? He appointed 12 apostles to help his work. Even he didn't do it alone. You remember Paul? Well, he asked for Timothy, a young Timothy, come along. Another time he says, send for Mark, for he is useful to me for the ministry. Even Paul, the great leader Paul, had to delegate to. And maybe that's what helped made him great. Good leaders will figure this out or they're going to get burned out. Elders will need deacons, and deacons will need saints. Preachers can get burned out as well if they don't delegate. I know for sure. I have seen, and I've seen this in other preacher friends and other places. And sometimes you listen to them and you say, you're doing this to yourself, brother. They take on every teaching aspect. And they need to delegate. God never planned for the teaching of His church to be just a one-man show. He may be the most skilled and experienced, but He should not do it all. Look in 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Again, this goes along with elders, with deacons. We've got to learn to delegate. In 2 Timothy 2:2, he says, and the things which you've heard, that is Timothy, the things that you've heard, Timothy, from me, Paul, the apostle, among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. In other words, delegate, Timothy. You know, there's, and I'm going to mention this quickly in passing, but there's a few extra class openings for the auditorium class, and it would be wonderful to have other men teach the class the rest of the year. This is my only quarter. And if I was a wise leader, I'd delegate, right? Wouldn't I? TJ, that's it. TJ and Tim, you guys got it, right? Thomas and Rich, you're going to do it. That'd be nice, right? I know Kevin's already stepping up. All good leaders will learn to delegate wisely as Nehemiah did. But he also knew how to motivate people. You see, I can volunteer people, but it's so much better when they make the choice to volunteer themselves. And that's where Nehemiah shined. He was able to motivate them, so it was a choice that they made, not just a name that I called, right? Notice I said motivate, not manipulate. He didn't try to convince people to do something that was only beneficial to him. People can see right through that. It is unconcerned about your fellow man. It is selfish. It leads nobody. It actually turns people away from you, and you lead no one. But Nehemiah, he drew people to him. Listen, future leaders to be, elders to be one day, the Bible calls you to be leaders, not lords. Right? So that means you have to develop a skill set to be able to find ways to motivate individuals for the good of that individual, and that they can see that and understand that. Now think about this feat of Nehemiah. The wall had been like this for years and years. We're talking many multiple decades. The temple was built, and then they left the wall alone for a long, long time. The first sight that greeted every visitor was a ruined wall. Piles of rubble. As a constant reminder that God's people were judged and sent into captivity. Well, what of the reminder then of His mercy, of His restoration, of His forgiveness? See, Nehemiah must have known how to motivate people to think about those kinds of things. Right? Not the hype or the theatrics or manipulation, but an explanation of how this goal was good for the people, good for God. It was attainable and desirable. But you know, when he marched into that town, he didn't blare a horn and say, "Here's what we're going to do." When we read the text, it says that he waited 3 days patiently. People would have wondered, who's this newcomer? What's this nobleman doing in our town? What is his business? Why does he keep staring at the walls? It was mysterious. There was some build-up to the moment, not a slap-in-the-face shock. Look there in Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 2, there verse 11. Good leaders will make sure that when they present things, it's not a slap-in-the-face shock. Right? Some build-up to it all. In Nehemiah 2:11, "So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I rose in the night and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Nor was there any animal with me except the one that I rode." So he goes on like this for a few days. Sneak away at night sometimes, look at the walls, see what needs to go on over in this section, what has to happen over here. First-hand account. Then verse 15, "So I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall. Then I turned back and entered the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the others who did the work. Then I said to them, 'You see the distress that we're in? How Jerusalem lies waste, and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach.' And I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me." So they said, who said it? So they said, "Let us rise up and build." Then they set their hands to this good work. You see, he made it almost as if it was their idea. Let's do this. This is so encouraging to be able to hear. He helped them to see that this was a work of God. Like I said, didn't slap them shockingly on the face about it. He built up to it. He showed the spiritual importance. He was sincere. He was believable. His enthusiasm was infectious. And his optimism was contagious. Leaders know how to motivate people to do good. Jesus was the greatest leader of all time. And he knew how to motivate fishermen to leave it all behind and catch men. He knew how to motivate tax collectors to leave all wealth behind and to find true riches. He knew how to motivate harlots to be wedded to God and not to men. He knew how to get the heart involved in the work, not just the actions. And that unless the heart was involved, then the actions were of no value. See, leaders will find a way to tap into the insides to motivate. Again, hard to do, but they find a way. I love what Paul does. Remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 13? 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Paul sees all this discussion and dispute over spiritual gifts. And you know, one saying, "Oh, I got this gift." And the other saying, "Well, I got that gift." And he's discouraged by that. He's saying, you know, you're forgetting what the reason for these gifts were for. And the purpose. And beyond that, what's the motive behind that action? And he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1, "Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but I have not love, I've become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal." You know, Paul's saying, I'm an apostle. And if I just had the gift to gab, if I was just this pure order and just brilliant in communicating the message of God, but I didn't have love behind it, he says, to God, it's like someone, a little monkey, just clanging the cymbals. No value. It's useless. Verse 2, "And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing." Great feats, great actions, but without the proper motivation behind it, it's of no value. So, good leaders find how to get to that core of the person so they can see the value in it and then take the idea as if it was their own. To recognize this is so important and must be done. But one of the greatest motivators to others is seeing in you the willingness to set the example. See, Nehemiah had a nice place in the palace, didn't he? As a cupbearer to the king. He had nice walls every day. He looked out his window. But these walls in Jerusalem, these were God's walls. And he knew he couldn't come in and command everybody like the brick masters of Egypt, cracking the whip, right? How motivated was that group? No, what did he do? He rolled up his sleeves and he got to work. See, that's another attribute of a wise master builder. He worked alongside the people too. He didn't say, "Hey, here's a great idea. Now, I don't want to do it, but I think you should." Friends, we laugh at that, but I've literally had people say those words to me before. More than once. "This is a good idea, but I don't want to be the one to do it." You know how far those ideas go? I bet you can guess. Nehemiah didn't do that at all. Good leaders don't ask others to do what they are unwilling to do themselves. Future leaders here, take note of that, please. Nehemiah rolled up his sleeves and worked as diligently as anyone else did. Look in Nehemiah chapter 4. Nehemiah chapter 4, there verse 6. So we built the walls, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. We got half the wall done, half to as high as it needs to go. We're going to keep building. We're not going to stop. There in chapter 4 and verse 23, so neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. He says, we just kept on going. He put in those days of nonstop work until the task was finished. In chapter 5, there, verse 14, he says, moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year into the 32nd year of the king Artaxerxes, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the governor's provisions. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people and took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. He says, all the other leaders in the past said, yeah, you do it, not me. And he says, no, I'm not going to be like that. Verse 16, indeed, I also continued the work on this wall, and we did not buy any land. We're not going to be distracted by any other pursuits. He was different than all the other leaders before. He was one of them. He didn't distinguish himself like the previous governors. All other governor business was on hold while he worked. Leaders of tomorrow will need to see the work is hardest at the top, not the easiest. For with great power comes great responsibility. There must also be great humility to stoop down and wash the disciples' feet to first show them how, or to lay the bricks alongside the people to show them the Spirit. Now, chapters 4 through 6 are a record of how he had so many obstacles. It was not easy to do this. The Red Sea did not just part for him. Nehemiah's enemies tried hard to stop him, and we didn't even read any of that. He just kept on working. Found a way. And no doubt, the Bible tells us in chapter 4 that what the enemies were doing were affecting the people. It says Jerusalem is starting their heart is starting to fail. But they keep following his lead. This is the kind of leadership that we need, friends. Men that will rise up in their work, in their homes, and in the church and say, follow me, not the world. Let's do this together. Women to rise up in their sphere of influence and say, let me show you a better way. Let's do this together. Whether male or female, we must remember the best leaders, Jesus said, were the best servants. And so the work is hardest at the tops. And we must be willing to serve. We may serve in different ways in the home and in the church, but these are effective ways to serve and to lead. Turn to chapter 6 and verse 15. Nehemiah did just that, and because of the initiative of this one man who loved God, the entire wall around Jerusalem was completed. And when? How long? Nehemiah 6:15. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Nehemiah, a wise master builder. He knew how to pray. He knew how to solve problems, to motivate people and to participate with people. He knew how to overcome obstacles, looking unto God. He was practical and determined and wise. And these are qualities needed in effective leadership today. May God bless us to develop them. Now notice in that list, I didn't say he was sinless. We can't hold our leaders today in the church to that standard. Nehemiah wasn't even held to that standard. In fact, in Nehemiah 1 verse 6, I didn't read all of that verse. We read verse 6, but we didn't read the full verse. At Nehemiah 1:6, after he says, "Please let your ear be attentive to your and your eyes open, and that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night." It goes on to say, "For the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you, both my father's house and I have sinned." Leaders do not need to pretend to be superhuman, but to be able to show that they are men and men at best. And we also must recognize and realize that of our leaders too, and I hold that against them for being human themselves. Else we'll miss out on some transformative leaders that can be beneficial to the spiritual kingdom of God and building the spiritual walls of God's kingdom. Thank you for your attention this morning. If you're here this morning, you're not a child of God. I realize this lesson was not made to teach you how to become a Christian. But hopefully you've been able to see in this lesson the growth God expects of us when we become a child of God. That our journey into becoming a Christian doesn't end at the point that we're baptized into Christ. It just begins. And that He wants to be on a journey with us to develop into the full measure and the stature of Jesus Christ. And with that goal in mind, well, we'll be growing all the days that we live. There's work in the kingdom to do, isn't there? There's work on me, there's work on you, and there's work on the body of Christ. Let us be wise master builders. If you're not God's child, would you repent and be baptized for the remission of your sins and start that journey with Him? If you are God's child but you've fallen away or you've gotten sidetracked, you've stopped building the wall and started building, buying land. Nehemiah didn't do that. Refocus again and grow. And if we can assist, won't you come while together we stand and while we sing?
Where that He loves is so fair as the day that blesses my way.